Hello and welcome to another episode of Sniffing the Pages. I'm Nina Manning.
I'm Katie Griffiths.
In this episode, we will be discussing Vox by Christina Dolcher. It's a fast-paced debut set in dystopian America about refusing to be silenced and reclaiming one's voice. I will be in conversation with Emily Gunnis discussing her evocative debut novel, The Girl in the Letter, a heart-wrenching novel combining mystery with emotional core. Katie will be telling us what she read next, and finally, we will be revealing two more brilliant reads, which we'll be discussing on the next podcast. So first, on to Vox, one of the most hottest books at the moment, and Katie is going to tell us what it's about.
So the blurb says, Jean McClellan spends her time in almost complete silence, limited to just 100 words a day. Any more, and 1,000 volts of electricity will course through her veins. Now the new government is in power, everything has changed, but only if you're a woman. Almost overnight, bank accounts are frozen, passports are taken away, and 70 million women lose their jobs. Even more terrifyingly, young girls are no longer taught to read or write. For herself, her daughter, and for every woman silenced, Jean will reclaim her voice. This is only the beginning. And this is 100 word limit reached. So that's 100 words to summarise the book. That's as many words as you get a day.
Imagine.
It's not very many words, guys.
Imagine if you and I, like, we've got to do a podcast, we've only got 100 words. Couldn't even imagine it, really. It's just...
It's so few.
It really unimaginable made me... and it's quite scary, isn't it?
It's terrifying. It is terrifying. This whole book really freaked me out. But also, it is interesting because it makes you think about language and how you communicate. And they, you know, this is what happens in the book, you know, sort of realise at the beginning, is that she sort of learns a new way of communication, like how to use your words efficiently, how to use them to save them effectively.
Mm.
And it's...
And also how much we use just body language, which they're not allowed to use either, because it's a bit sort of 1984 George Orwell, isn't it? Big Brother is watching you, TV cameras.
So there's cameras and they're not allowed to sort of write notes to people as well, because otherwise you could just... And I think there's a bit in it where... two women were taken away for sort of using sign language.
Mm. It was the mums in the shop, wasn't
it? Yeah, they're sort of using basic sign language to chat to each other that way, and they were taken away and punished for that. So basically, it's not... It is words, but it's communication. It's stopping women communicating. And it is. I mean, it's a dystopian novel, and it... The thing about it that really scared me is, although it is obviously this kind of awful dystopian future, at the same time, it's oddly plausible.
Especially in America at the moment with the way
Trump's
leading the country.
And genuinely, I think that's obviously what it's intended to be. It's intended to be a sort of...
Trumpopian.
Yeah, good word.
You can have that.
Thank you. it's intended to be this kind of scare story of like, or, you know, if we're not careful, if you don't fight at the sort of little things that are happening, things will escalate.
Very quickly.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that happens, isn't it? Is, you know, that
overnight
stuff starts to happen, people are protesting, but the wrong people are in power, and very, very quickly this plan's put into action. And you think about it, I think that could never happen. They could never do that. Women just wouldn't stand for it. But I think that's the whole point of this, is that main character, that's what she was thinking.
Mm.
It won't happen. This won't happen. But it does.
Yeah.
And that's what's so scary, is you find yourself... The thing I found really upsetting about it was her daughter. So she's got a 5-year-old daughter.
And I just Sylvia.
Thought, yeah, and it just made me... Is that her name?
I think it is Sylvia, isn't it? Or something like that.
Yeah.
So have a flick through. Sonia? No, I think it's Sylvia.
Hang on.
But yeah, let's just talk about what happens. Sonia. So it's basically the church is at the forefront of the regime, and women are... made to wear these, well, what are they called? Jean didn't want them to be called bracelets.
So they were called counters.
Counters, right, yeah.
So they count how many, they're like keyed to your voice, and they count how many words you speak a day.
You can choose a nice colour, pink.
Yes, yeah, so you can choose a pretty pink one, obviously. If you go over 100 volts. And I think it's the more words you go over, the worse the electric shocks get. So you say one or two words too many, and it's like a buzz, and then you say... hundreds of words too many and you're screaming on the floor.
I think eventually your body would start to get used to the pain. So I think with each time you go over, it will increase
yeah.
pain level.
And as you said, yeah, this is like the religious right basically have kind of come to power, and it's this, we need to go back to a time when women didn't go out to work, when women didn't have a voice, when they just belonged to their husbands and did what they were told, and obviously everything was better then, and that's the sort of rhetoric they're going on.
And all the books are taken away.
Yeah, so yeah, all the books are sign language. Girls aren't taught to read and write, they're taught like basic maths so that they'll be able to do kind of shopping basically and run a household.
But like in George Orwell novel, there's the TV that's on.
Yeah.
They're sort of expected, aren't they, supposed to watch the television, see the news, watch people become paraded up onto the stage.
Yeah, people who've broken the rules are sort of, yeah, made example of. And it's not just the women, that's over, there's also this anyone who's homosexual is taken away from their partner, or if they're single, they're paired up with
another.
So basically, gay men and gay women are paired up together and made to live together in in camps, in a cell together, in the hope that they'll get the idea and become heterosexual again. Mm. So that's how it works. So yeah, this.
Yeah. Awful. They're not very nice places, are they?
No, this whole thing is just. Yeah, the scary thing about it is that you just know that there are probably people, there definitely are people, in America and probably even in this country as well, who would read like the first half of this and be like, well, that sounds brilliant, let's do that. Whereas, you know, we're reading it going, oh my God, this is horrific.
Yeah,
some people who are reading this who genuinely do think like that.
But I think it's a very, very easy place to jump to when people see the initial premise of the book. What was it about? Oh, it's where women are only allowed to speak 100 words. Oh, yeah, great, yeah, that sounds brilliant. You know, yeah, that's exactly. Just, you know, kind of Neanderthal kind of.
But what was interesting about it was like her husband's reaction to it as well.
That's an insult to Neanderthals, actually. You know.
Probably. Yeah. Yeah, so it's one of the interesting things is how the men in their lives react as well.
Hmm. So Patrick is a husband, and he's kind of torn, isn't he? He's sort of in the middle.
He works for the government, and he's got as little choice in it as she has. Like, it's not that the men in your life decide whether or not you have to wear the counter. Every woman has to wear them, and you know, if men speak out against it, then they're going to get taken away as well. So,
and Patrick works very closely, doesn't he, with I can't remember who the guy is. Is it a reverend?
So there's a reverend who's sort of the kind of driving force behind this, what's called the Pure Movement.
Mm.
And then there's a president who's been elected as kind of the poster boy for this, I guess, whole movement and process. And so Patrick works quite high up in that government.
And then Jean's had to give up her job. So this is quite relevant. She was studying aphasia, which is the study of lost language, which is relevant to the book because then she's asked to create this.
Yeah, so she's asked to go. She's asked to get offered the opportunity to take her counter off and to go back to work to help the president's brother because he's had an accident where he's lost his power of speech, and that's what she worked on before she lost her job and her voice. She was working on a treatment to solve that.
Mm.
So she gets this opportunity to go back and do this, and then it obviously all sort of escalates from there, and I guess it's her journey, isn't it, from being someone who's really politically apathetic. Like it says at the beginning, she didn't even vote in that election that led to this. She didn't vote, and then now this has happened to her.
Yeah.
So I guess in some senses it's also a bit of like not a call to arms, but a call to remember that you should, even if you're not into politics,
just use your vote.
Engage a little bit, yeah. Use your vote. Otherwise, bad shit can happen.
Yeah. I think the first half of the novel for me was dark and disturbing and scary, and then it kind of flipped genre the second half, and then it became very kind of blockbustery movie, fast-paced, kind of,
yeah,
you know, let's find the cure and let's kind of kill the baddies. And
yeah, so I think it did. It's
totally
sort of
different.
And the pacing changed, and it's difficult. I don't want to talk about how it ends or how what happens in the second half, really, because that'll ruin it if people haven't read it yet. But I did think that the change in pace, or the change in kind of how the story was being told, felt a little bit jarring at times, because it was just this big, deep, scary horror thing, and then suddenly. Yeah, it's almost like this blockbuster that you can almost see it playing out on screen. all these sort of, not fight scenes, but a sense of drama that really heightens.
Yeah, the darkness kind of faded for me, and it became a little bit more lighthearted, I guess, in that sense. But I think for people who want that kind of page-turning book, the chapters were really short. That was nice.
And yeah, I couldn't put it down. I needed to finish it. I think I sent you a text saying, I'm 100 pages from the end and I can't get a bed.
That's interesting. You were in 100 pages and 100 words.
Yeah, see the link. Absolutely. Can't stop.
But I think the first half, I definitely had some questions, and I'll pose these to you and you'd see if you agreed with me as well. So there was bits, so when Sylvia, I think that is her name, the little girl, so she's
Sonia,
five.
Sonia, we checked.
Is it
yeah.
Sonia?
Yeah.
Why am I saying Sylvia? Where
know.
Did I get Sylvia
from? It's probably a different book we've read.
I prefer Sylvia.
Okay. We'll just change it.
No, Sonia. Damn. So Sonia is five, and she wears one of these bracelets. And she has a nightmare, doesn't she, at night? And
yeah.
She's screaming out in her sleep, so she's saying lots and lots of words. Suddenly, Mum's out of bed, Jean, she's running, Dad's out of bed, Patrick, even the boys, her other children, are running to her bedside to try and soothe her, to stop her from using up her quota. So then it got me questioning, how does it work when... Because this has been going on for a year, this already, this regime had been in place. So... What would it have been like for babies who are just learning to talk and babbling, and, you know, how do you control that? Is it literally like a, you know...
I think they just learn. I think the idea is that...
It's learnt behaviour, so...
Yeah, if you talk too much, you get hurt, you'll stop doing it.
Because she didn't touch on that at all. It was literally just what had happened, what was going on with her
family. Well, she sort of dealt with what she did with Sonia, which is she didn't want Sonia to learn with that negative pain, so rather than sort of allowing her daughter to go to the 100 words and then get hurt, she rewarded her positively every time she didn't use her words. So, well, the opposite of what you probably normally do with a child, like we're sort of constantly saying that to children, aren't we? Use your words.
Yeah. The school were doing that as well, weren't they? They were giving out prizes and she was coming home with
it's about making a sort of reward out of it. So every time she indicated or gestured what she wanted rather than using her words, she got a treat or something to make it. And that's how she was taught not to speak, not to use her words.
Yeah, I found that really disturbing, that part. Just
it was really freaky, because my daughter's four, nearly five, and the thought of trying to stop her talking is just horrifying. She talks constantly.
Yeah.
But just all that chatter, the thought of taking that out of the world is just so upsetting and so awful.
Some of the other questions I had were, how would this have happened so suddenly overnight? Because I think if you remove half of the workforce overnight, pretty much, surely like the whole economy would have just like crumbled.
Yeah, it did touch on that a little bit, didn't it? But it wasn't really clear how it had happened.
I think she touched on something like, oh yeah, some of the men are a bit peed off because they kind of got to do some of the women. There's a bit of extra work to do. I mean, it was really
vague. There was a little bit where it kind of talked about how it had been managed. That was one of the reasons that people said it couldn't happen, and there obviously was this plan, but it was a little bit vague about it. I think that's the thing about it. So the concept of this book's amazing, and terrifying and really scary. But actually, when you're reading the first half of it, you do really feel that kind of horror, and it's really dark. But it was reasonably vague on the details of how they, mind you, maybe that's just because she doesn't want to give anyone any ideas. But it was a little bit vague on the sort of practicalities of how it actually happened.
But then I think what you were saying about giving people ideas, in the book, Stephen is her son and he's 17. And he is very, very influenced. He's at that age where he's highly influenced by many things.
Yeah, so I found his character arc through the book probably my favourite one.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I mean, it was upsetting in lots of ways because it was, you know, he was so easily influenced by it. But his, again, not wanting to ruin it for anyone, but his sort of arc through the second half of the book, I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah, I think it was almost his character could mirror what would happen in reality. And the irony there is that she's written that this could essentially happen. You know, these boys are being influenced all over the place, these subtle subtleties that are being dropped into society everywhere, billboards, you know, into textbooks, all these sort of things. He's coming home and quoting from texts.
Yeah, he's taking this new class at school that's giving him easy extra credit, so he wants to take it. And then this is like, yeah, the textbook sort of telling them, obviously, it would make more sense. Everything would, you know, these are all the reasons it would be better if women didn't go out to work. These are the reasons it would make sense for women to be the ones who stayed at home and
did
these things, and how much easier it would therefore be for men because they wouldn't need to worry about all these things that women are now taking care of. Like,
yeah, so the irony is that essentially people could take this book and specifically that first half of it and think, oh, you know, and be influenced by that.
Yeah, definitely.
In a sense.
And I think that in some ways that's what's scary about it, is that there are, that's why it's frightening, is because it feels quite plausible, because you can read how Stephen sort of starts to hear more about it and starts to buy into it because he's that quite easily influenced age, and you think, yeah, I can see how that would happen, you know, if you did start doing that in textbooks, in media, just sort of social messaging generally. You can see how boys and girls as well of that age would start to take it on board and really believe it. And he does start to really believe that it's true, even though he's been brought up by you know, a mum who goes out to work, who's obviously quite independent. You know, he's not been brought up to think a woman's place is in the home, but it doesn't take huge amounts of education or conditioning to make him start to think that that's a good idea.
I thought it was quite interesting when she did go back into work, how blasé the men were about her being back in the workforce and being around all these men. And also, she was quite rude to them. I mean, not rude, but I mean, she was kind of stuck up for herself and spoke up, didn't she? And nobody kind of really sort of...
I think they probably... It's an element of this, them knowing that they...
She's going to go back.
She's not really a threat. Yeah. So they're feeling... They're so secure in their position that they don't...
But did they know? No, they didn't.
Yeah. But they're so, they're so secure in this position they can afford to just let her...
Mouth off
a little bit, because she's not really, you know, they don't consider her really to be a threat to the status quo. So, yeah, it's interesting. I think it brings up a lot of issues, I guess. I don't know what the word is.
I think one of the other issues that I was reading about online was a lot of Christians have an issue with this book because of the way Christianity is used in the novel.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a positive portrayal of Christianity, but then there are people in the US in particular who do use Christianity in this way, who do take their beliefs to these extremes. And it's not a fair representation of all people who are all Christianity by any stretch of the imagination. Most people I know who are Christian are very nice people, you know, very moderate, and don't think that women should never speak about any of this craziness, but it's, you can't pretend that there aren't people in the world who do use Christianity as, maybe it's their excuse, whatever, to control women, but that is the excuse that they're using. And it's, to a certain extent, it's not factual, not, the book's not factual, but the fact that women, the fact that people who are, profess to be Christian hold these opinions, that is real.
Yeah, sort of the whole forming of clans.
Yeah.
It's very, very easy. I think it's an innate within us, isn't it, to want to be part of a clan, want to be part of a group. We start as children, it goes into our teenage years, we want to be part of the cool gang, and then it carries on into adulthood, you know, with football clubs and all that kind of stuff. It's basically easy, you know, which is why when we look at the Holocaust, you know, as dreadful as, you know, and awful as that was, if you study it and you think about it, it actually was a very easy thing
I think this is what it's sort
Hitler
of,
to be able to do.
Yeah, and that's why I think that Stephen, her son's story, is so frightening and so interesting, is that you can really see it. And that there are parallels you could draw to kind of, yeah, to Hitler and the Nazis, or even other stuff that's going on these days, is that it's so easy to convince people that what you're telling them is true. And then they believe it wholeheartedly, and then they're prepared to do awful things to maintain that, because they've been convinced it's true.
And to stay within the group, and to, you know,
yeah,
be,
and to
and
not
kind of
yeah,
follow
to
the crowd
challenge,
and do what everybody
exactly.
else is doing.
And yeah, there's an element of fear, but there's also an element of, yeah, as you say, human nature, liking, wanting to be in that group, wanting to be accepted, and wanting someone to blame for your problems as well. Like, it's nice to be told if you've got, you're not as successful as you wanted to be, or whatever the problem is. It's nice to be given a scape, like, the reason that life isn't as good as it used to be for men is because women have got above their place, and women have gone out to work, and they shouldn't have, and we should have, you know, women should be seen and not heard, and we should go back to that. And for people who are sort of disenchanted or disenfranchised, it's really easy to latch onto that and think, actually, yeah, that's the reason I haven't got what I want, and to turn people, give people someone to blame.
Mm. So did you enjoy the sciencey parts of it? Because
I like, so I think
as a scientist, yeah, I'm not
a linguist even remotely, but so Christina Dulcher, she is a linguist who wrote it, and I liked the fact that she obviously is a linguist, and the way that she writes about language and language use and language development and that, all that kind of stuff to do with the aphasia and language loss and being able to re-find lost language. I really enjoyed that way that she wrote about it, and that was a nice element to the book, that she had that knowledge and that she didn't shy away from using that knowledge in the book.
Yeah, I think what I found quite fascinating was, I think I mentioned it before, was just the way the pace changed halfway through. And I guess what I kind of sum it up in my head is, and this might not be relevant to you or many listeners who are not from my era, but in the 80s there was a television programme called The A-Team, and it was about
The A-Team. I'm that much younger than you.
I remember that much older than you. which was four guys who had ex-criminals, well, not ex, I think they'd escaped from prison, so they were still actually criminals, they were on the run from the government, and so they just would kind of constantly sort of turn up in these scenarios in each episode and sort of save the day. But there'd be a scene where they'd kind of be trapped and they couldn't get out, so maybe they'd be sort of walk into a barn and then suddenly they'd be surrounded and there was no way out. So they had to, what they do is they'd create something like a machine or a vehicle out of whatever was kind of to hand, like, you know, a few nuts and bolts and a bit of straw or something, and then literally bust their way out of this barn. Anyway, so where I'm going with this is, this was actually called kind of the 18 moments, or
yeah,
sort of the so when I watch films or read books, I kind of liken it to that a little bit, the 18 moment, and I felt like in this book there was definitely that point.
Yeah, there was a really clear
where they
moment.
Kind of went, we're busting out of here, you know, we're gonna do this, and it kind of went all
we're
a bit
do this, it's gonna
oh, it went a bit 18-y blockbustery.
Yeah. I think it was just,
and it really ramped up the pace then, didn't it, towards,
I mean, I understand that it's, you know, it's a short page turny, pacey book, but to me it could have been longer.
Mm.
Easily, comfortably, it could have been a bit longer. There could have been a bit more time spent on that second half and that resolution. I don't think it would. I think it still would have been a page turner, to be honest, for me anyway. But
just a few more pages to turn.
Yeah. But and I do know that I read a lot faster than other people. So
yeah, yeah. You probably found yourself at the end way before you.
I can understand.
Expected to.
Yeah, I just think the end came quite quick for me, and I was really was enjoying the book, and it could have taken it go lasting a bit longer, or taking it a bit more slowly towards the end.
Yeah, so let's talk about the end, because I've read a few reviews online and few people have said they're not big fans of Jean, because of the way in which the book ends and she sort of walks off into the sunset.
See, it's not really a problem I have with her as a character, although I think the resolution for her as a character was maybe a little bit disappointing in some senses. I just felt that the ending was quite, it wasn't my favourite ending. I don't want to ruin it, and I think some people will probably love it. And in some ways I did like it. I wanted at least part of the ending that I got when I was reading it.
I think there'll be people who will love that ending. I'm on the same page as you. But there will be people who need that definitive resolution at the end of a book that says,
yeah,
this is exactly
just
what happened, and tied it all up nicely. And
it was just such a complicated, messy concept. Like, I don't mean messy in a negative way, I just mean it was this it's such an amazing concept, this book, and it's so challenging and difficult to process. I felt it could have done with a bit more of that challenge and difficulty in the ending or in the resolution.
Yeah, and like I said to you before, maybe sort of going back, because she's in another country at the end, basically. I'm going to say that because I can't not say that.
Yeah.
So she's not in America anymore, you know, and things have changed. And, yeah, I just would have liked to have known a little bit more about how it changed back again. But yeah, then I suppose anything, in the beginning it didn't give you too much information about how it got there. So
I think that's it. I think I would have just liked to, I would have liked to have spent a bit more time on the aftermath of what happened in the book. Just a little bit more time with the outcome. Maybe there'll be a sequel. But that sort, yeah.
And it'll be all the men that only have 100 words.
That'd be great, wouldn't it? Imagine. obviously, it wouldn't really. My husband would not survive.
Imagine my husband, he goes out and sings. He'd just be like, sing like two lines and have to come home. Great, I'd see more of him.
You would see more of him, but you wouldn't hear more of him.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, apart from him, what did you star rating it as?
I star rated it 4, but I might down that to like 3.5 or something, because again, I think super loved the first half, the darkness. I just really got immersed in that kind of Handmaid's Tale. And actually, I don't want to be that person that tries to compare a book to another book, but it is getting compared to The Handmaid's Tale. There's no doubt about that, because it is the most recent relevant book of this genre. But with The Handmaid's Tale, it's very dark, dystopian novel throughout. It doesn't ever get any lighter.
No point to that book. Get cheerful, no.
I had to stop halfway through because I was pregnant. I thought, I cannot do this
anymore.
Yeah,
no, that's not a good book to read pregnant. Nope.
I think it kind of got hyped up as, you know, the next Handmaid's Tale or the next The Power, which is a very sort of dark kind of dystopian.
I feel really conflicted about it in a way, because in some ways I prefer this because it's got a element of hope or resistance to it that I think is a positive message, you know, that you can... you can fight back.
Yeah.
You don't have to take it lying down. Do go out. Do protest. Do vote. It's a bit of a call to arms in that sense. And in lots of ways, I think that's a really good and really positive message. So,
I was thrilled to read The Girl in the Letter by Emily Gunness. It was tragically painful to read the horrors within the walls of St. Margaret's Home for Pregnant Mothers. But Emily has created a colourful cast of characters, a fast-paced narrative, and some incredibly sinister murders. It's a fantastic debut, and I read it with intrigue and fascination. I spoke to Emily this week, and she told me about her motivation for the book, as well as a sneaky preview into her new novel. And I must add, during this interview, we neglected to name Emily's late mother, who is the best-selling author, Penny Vincenzi. Before I chat to Emily, here is the blurb for The Girl in the Letter. 1956. When Ivy Jenkins falls pregnant, she is sent in disgrace to St. Margaret's, a dark, brooding house for unmarried mothers. Her baby is adopted against her will. Ivy will never leave. Present day. Samantha Harper is a journalist desperate for a break. When she stumbles on a letter from the past, the contents shock and move her. The letter is from a young mother begging to be rescued from St. Margaret's before it's too late. Sam is pulled into the tragic story and discovers a spate of unexplained deaths surrounding the woman and her child. With St. Margaret set for demolition, Sam has only a few hours to piece together a 60-year-old mystery before the truth, which lies disturbingly close to home, is lost forever. I've sent an advanced reader copy of The Girl in the Letter by Emily Gunness. I read it over a couple of days, and although tough to read in some of the more harrowing parts, it was a book I was unable to put down, and it will linger with me for a long time. The Girl in the Letter is published in paperback on the 4th of April, and right now I have Emily here to chat about the book. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Nina. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks ever so much for joining us on Sniffing the Pages.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations to you on a magnificent debut.
Thank you so much.
So The Girl in the Letter has already been a number one bestseller in the Kindle charts. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, it's very exciting. Yes, we've sold quite a few copies.
So how is the publicity experience faring so far for you?
Well, I'm loving it. I was so new to it all because although my mother was a writer, I had no idea about this whole world of bloggers and, you know, what an amazing job they do. Of spreading the word, because there's so many books out there. There's such a, you know, cascade of stuff for people to read, and getting noticed is tricky, but Headline really know what they're doing, and I've got a brilliant Phoebe Swinburne. Headline's just been brilliant at spreading the word, and the bloggers have been really positive about it all, so it's just exciting. And then it kind of gets picked up and read, and the reviews on Amazon have been great as well. I've been really lucky. I've got over 700 reviews now, which is great.
Yeah.
And it really helps to sell books and get the word out there, really.
Yeah.
So, I've been very lucky.
Good. It's interesting you're saying about your mum, because I guess the process now in publishing is so different to how it was when her books were being published.
Yeah.
It's changed so much, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. And she was very much in the era of the blockbuster. So yeah. I was quite young. I was 13, so I don't remember loads about it at the time, but I do remember her. She had to do a lot. She had to work hard. I remember she always said it was 1 year writing, 1 year promoting. But I think what she did was she wrote a lot of, you know, articles for people, because she was a journalist before she was a writer. So she'd, you know, write features for, you know, Good Housekeeping magazine, who she used to work for, or, you know, The Mirror, who she used to work for, and kind of, she had a lot of people loved her, and a lot of people kind of helped spread the word that way. Whereas she didn't have social media, she didn't have a Twitter account or an Instagram account, and there were no book bloggers then. So it has really changed now, but I think, you know, she still had to put in the work.
Yeah, absolutely.
But no, it was, I learned a lot from her in terms of, she always said, you know, be nice to everyone, except if you've got a real gripe, then stick up for yourself. She always said that.
That's really good advice. That's pretty much the advice I give to my kids. So
yeah,
good advice. Yeah.
So it's set in sort of over 3 years between 1953 and 1956. And then it's set in the modern day as well, so 2017.
Yeah.
And these letters kind of that are written by Ivy at St Margaret's take place over kind of an 18-month period. But it's just what's happening around that time before she gets pregnant and after she gets pregnant, you know, what happened to her. And yeah, so Sam has to piece together these letters, and she gets them kind of one by one. And they just grab her straight away, because she's a single mother as well. And she just can't believe what Ivy went through. And she just starts to read these letters and slowly realises that everyone who's mentioned in these letters that worked at the homes or had anything to do with this St Margaret's came to a rather sorry and premature end. So she starts to look into this and unravel the mystery, which has quite an exciting twist at the end.
Yes, it does. I loved it. I loved it. My co-host is just in the process of reading it at the moment, so she's getting stuck into it as well.
But
so your although you mention in your author's notes at the end what made you write this book, can you just tell our listeners what was the driving force behind writing such an evocative novel?
So what originally drew me to this story was the idea of twins and being separated at birth and never knowing about one another. I remember reading an article about two twins who were brought up, one in a very hard up family and one in a very wealthy family. And then like 50 years later, they found out about one another's existence. And they both had very similar attitudes towards life, you know, very similar outlook. They were still drawn to the same things, you know. And it's that nature nurture debate has always interested me. And around about the time I was thinking about how that would make an interesting story, you know, obviously it's not enough, just that on its own.
Mm.
And I read an article by Steve O'Riordan about the Magdalen laundries. And I saw Philomena came out as well with Judy Dench.
Mm,
and I just started to become aware of these homes in Ireland, and I'd had my baby, and I was thinking, you know, how could someone cope with that, you know, your baby being taken away from you. You'd just never get over it.
Mm.
And And then I started to do some more research, and then all these on YouTube, and there were all these videos of women in the UK this had happened to. And I just had never heard about this, that there were women in this country. It wasn't just Ireland. And although the laundries weren't so prevalent here, they, you know, they were still a lot of hundreds of thousands of women had been forced to give up their children, because basically they just weren't told their rights. They were told they, you know, they weren't entitled to any assistance from the council. They weren't entitled to any benefits. They weren't, you know, entitled to any help. Mm. And, you know, they were lied to, really. And yeah. forced into a corner.
Mm.
And I just thought this was, you know, awful and fascinating, and would make a good backdrop for the twins.
Yeah.
And so I just started bashing out some ideas, really.
And they all came together beautifully.
And
it's interesting you say about the Philomena, because that was exactly what the film that was running through my mind. I mean, I hope you don't mind me saying so. The comparison between the two.
Yes.
Quite often when I read anyway, I visualise books as films.
Of course, yes.
And it was just that one scene when she goes sort of running to the window. And I think in your book, there was something similar. And then it reminded me of that scene, you know, when they would see their child being taken away. And I think that's just things like that.
Yes.
I mean, there was specific things that you wrote that were hard to take in. It was just part of the book, but it's just that notion that ran through the book that these awful things did happen. I think those are the sort of books that sit with you. It's the truth and the reality, you know, that gets hidden, and you know, it's just horrible, really, isn't it?
Yes. And it was quite upsetting reading a lot of it.
Mm.
But I'm quite pleased that this is getting to be more well known now, because I think a lot of these institutions, you know, they thrived on the shame, they thrived on the women's silence.
Yeah.
And you know, if people are talking about it more now, you know, it really helps. And I think it's a good thing.
Yeah. So talking about those bits that you had to write, how was it to write those parts then? Obviously you sort of read quite a lot of research, so that was quite helpful, you said, to read, but then actually having to sit down and write your own version of that.
The letters were actually the last minute in they went into the book at the last minute, because my agent Kate Barker, who's brilliant, she sort of said, I think we need a voice from inside the house, you know, we need to hear first person narrative. And I had read so much and watched so much footage, and they poured out of me. You have days where you write 10 words and it's torture.
Yeah.
And the letters just poured out of me, because I just knew there was such a formulaic what they did to these girls. And it was just every single one, you know, you got pregnant, you went to the doctor referred them, they were sent away as soon as they started to show, you know, then they were put to work, then they, you know, everything was so formulaic. And I just knew it all as if I'd lived it. Obviously, that's an insulting thing to say, but I really did feel like I knew, you know, I'd read so many accounts. And Ivy just came, was the last character, and she just came to life and brought the book to life. And it was very emotional, but it was very good to bring it all together. It was very exciting as well.
So you cast a lot of characters in The Girl in the Letter. What was your intention there? Didn't you begin with so many characters?
So the thinking behind that was that basically I wanted to make the point that these institutions, the nuns, were not really the face of this. They're the face of the institution, but they weren't. It took a community, you know, for them to be able to pull this off. It took doctors and, you know, mothers, fathers, uncles, adoption agencies. It wasn't just the work of these, you know, these nuns.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to make that point that, and so obviously in doing that, you've already got your seven characters. And then, you know, from that, you've got obviously Ivy, who went to the home, you've got her parents, you've got, you know, all the people who were involved at the home, you've got Sam in modern day. So obviously the character, it was creeping up the numbers. But I think the people who really enjoy the book and read it in two or three sittings can keep up.
Yeah.
they you know, you never get anyone saying, I read this in two sittings and I couldn't keep up.
Yeah.
People who can't keep up tend to be the people who put it down and go back to it.
Yeah.
I feel I failed there anyway. If someone can put it down, I failed. So I think that is not a book for them.
Yeah. Yeah, when I was taking notes, I put the characters into goodies and baddies.
Yeah, no,
just
there
so
was.
I could remember back. I was like, yeah. So
yeah.
That was a good one.
Yeah, I'll do that. I'll put that at the front of the next book.
Yeah. Because it kind of, yeah, it just breaks the characters into sort of two sections, really. Yeah. There's the good and the evil, isn't there, really?
Mm. Yeah.
So on to some more happier notes.
Yeah.
When you're writing in dual time, do you have a preference for either writing in the history or present day, or do you feel differently when you're writing in both of those sections of the book?
I absolutely love the idea that we are our past and we are our relatives and our grandparents and our great grandparents and all the things that have brought us to this moment in our life, you know, brought us into being, and the tiny things that could have happened or didn't happen that have changed everything in our lives. And I just love that idea that the recent past, you know, the 50s, it seemed like it was such a modern time, things were really changing, but it wasn't. You know, it was a Victorian value still. People were still very, very stuck, you know, entrenched in the church, entrenched in, you know, family. You know, your family was everything. You didn't argue. Everyone went to church on Sunday. You know, it's unimaginable. It's not, obviously, you know, a lot of people still go to church, but I'm just pointing out that the hold that the church had over society is so different to how it is now. And I just think it's so interesting that things that happened really fairly quite recently are unimaginable now, but yet they would have influenced our mothers and our grandmothers, you know, hugely. And then that in turn would have shaped their characters, which then shape our characters. You know, the women whose husbands came home from the war, they really couldn't do anything about their lives, but what they could do is influence their daughters to live their, you know, lives. The men went off to war. They had an amazing, the women, you know, had all this freedom they'd never experienced before. And then the men came home and they had to go back to how things were before. Mm. And they couldn't, you know, they couldn't change. They didn't want to leave their, you know, desert their husbands when they'd been through hell on earth. But what they could do was tell their daughters not to live, you know, that there was more to life than, you know, being at home. And I think that it's so fascinating that what happened to our mothers, influences us, and what happened to our grandmothers influences our, you know, our mothers. And we're just a product of our past, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just love tying all that together. I just find it fascinating.
Mm. So that answers my question about your researching. Do you enjoy the research process? And is there quite a lot of research in your new book that you've had to do? So are you enjoying that process as well?
Yeah, I love research. It's my favourite bit, because talking to people is when you get ideas. I made the big mistake of when I first started writing, I'd make a list of questions. And then I'd go and meet someone who had kindly agreed to give up their time. And then I'd start on the question one and I'd say, you know, would this happen? And they'd say, not really. And then I'd be like, oh, shit. And then at the question two, okay, well, would this happen? And they'd say, well, maybe, but probably not. And you're just like, you go into free fall and you panic. And the whole thing just comes to this kind of grinding halt. And then they start looking at their watch. And you've got your list of 50 questions going, oh God. And whereas what my mother used to do is go out with people and get them drunk and just spend hours talking about the subject. And then she'd come away with all these wonderful nuggets of ideas, which she would then go off and research.
Yeah.
So it's a much better way of approaching it. And luckily I've got two very small children, so I can't get drunk very much at the moment, but I definitely am much more meet someone and just talk and chat and just try and find out the essence of what it is that I'm trying to get at, and can I make that work or not, and then go away and do all the reading around it. And that is what is really exciting, because it's kind of chicken and egg. You can't decide what your book's going to be about until you speak to someone about, you know, research.
Mm.
But then if you don't have a vague idea, who do you speak to? So it's kind of, you do a bit of research, then you write a bit, then you do a bit of research, and then you write a bit. Can I talk about book two?
Yeah, go for it.
So I got this wonderful, so I wrote The Girl in the Letter, and I got this two-book deal, and it was so exciting. You're like, oh my God, I've got a two-book deal. And then you're like, oh God, I've got a two-book deal. I've got to write another book. And I have just no ideas at all. And I was panicking. And, you know, my editor, my lovely editor, Cherise Hobbs at Headline, was saying, oh, have you got any ideas? And I kind of told her a couple of vague ideas, but I knew they really weren't juicy enough.
Yeah.
And I went away with my husband to the Goodwood Hotel in Chichester for the night to celebrate the book deal. And I was like, what am I going to write this book about? God, I'm panicking. And we spotted this map on the wall next to the bar. And it's this really old black and white map of the area. And in the middle of it, it said County Lunatic Asylum. So I was like, oh, okay. Obviously, asylums have been done to death. But at the same time, I was like, okay, this could be a good dual narrative. You know, I'm going to go and visit it. So I phoned my mother-in-law, who's an ex-police detective from the 70s, and said, do you know that? Yeah, I know, she's amazing. She's been so much help. And I said, do you know this place in Chichester, Grailingwell? She said, oh, yes, I took a few, you know, poor souls there once in the 70s. And I was like, well, can you come and look at it with me? Can we go and see what's still there? So we went for the day, and it was just fascinating. It's been made into really posh flats, but you can still see in the grounds the old buildings, and you can just feel, you can feel still what, you know, the place when it was how it was. And I was talking to her on the way back, and we were just chatting, and I was like, you know, it's all very well, it's an asylum, but what's my angle here? Like, and she just was chatting away about the weather and about, you know, what, nothing. And then she suddenly said, well, do you know that until around about the 50s, if a wealthy man in this area was bored with his wife, he could just have her put in there and then he could marry his mistress, because you could only get divorce on the grounds of insanity, in adultery or death.
Sorry, up until what, the 50s, did you say?
I don't know the exact date. I'll have to look it up.
But roundabout. Quite,
yes. Recently, recent history. And I was like, oh my God, that's book two. So yes, so it's now about, you know, that I just thought that was just horrific. And she'd have had, you know, no say over her children. Mm. And, you know, people were for sale then. You could buy, like, you know, or much more, you know, if you had a wealthy man who's doctor, you know, you could pay for a referral. Horrific, but
shocking, isn't it?
Huh?
It's absolutely shocking.
Yeah,
didn't know.
I know exactly. So I started to run with that, really.
And what's the second book called? Because I saw your title pop up and your cover, your brand new cover pop up on Instagram today. So I was like, ooh.
I know. I love it. I love it. I'm so lucky with my covers.
So the title is called
The Lost Child.
The Lost Child.
So it's about two women, one in 1948 and one in 2012, and they both have postnatal psychosis. So I've been doing a lot of research about,
again, so that's a huge topic and subject. Yes. I've seen a lot of this across social media recently. Carry on.
So a lot of so obviously it's about their you know, how their treatments differed. So you've got one woman would have ended up in an asylum in the 1940s, and one, you know, in the modern day, you'd have hoped she'd end up in a mother and baby unit, although it does get missed, and the NHS are very stretched. But the point of my story is that you've got this girl, so the girl in the modern day, who's called Jessie, she's grieving over the death of her mother, and she has this baby. And it's very common for older mothers who have who are career women who have their babies quite late to suffer from psychosis, because they think they can cope, and it's very different, their image of motherhood to the reality,
right?
And they're used to their lives being very controlled and being in charge, you know, being in control of everything, and they don't get help because they're ashamed, because they think they should be able to cope, because they've always been very independent. And psychosis is like a switch. It's not like depression in that it builds and builds. It just, you can literally, you something in your brain just switches. And so this girl, Jessie, she has her baby, and she becomes convinced very quickly she's exhausted. She has a 3-day labour and then she's exhausted, which I had with Grace. And she's exhausted and she starts to hear the doctors talking about, you know, they're trying to kill her baby. So she goes on the run. She manages to get out of the hospital and she goes on the run with her baby. And so you've got basically the police looking for her, the press are looking for her, her father's looking for her. And then there's this fourth narrative, which you think is her. You think it's the girl in 2012, but it's not. It's the woman in 1957 on the run with her baby. And it's her reflecting back. And then in the modern day, everything ties up and you meet all the characters kind of link up together. And there's a link between what happens to the baby in 1957, the baby of the mother with psychosis in 1957, and the baby in 2012. So it all kind of arcs together and it's exciting. Fascinating.
I like all the nice tidy links at the end and it all just, and you know, the big reveals and it all kind of making sense. And you sound really passionate when you're talking about it, which is really it's even more exciting.
I'm really in love with that one at the moment.
Yeah, but you have to be, don't you? So are you at the end of the process?
Yes, so I'm about 90,000 words in, so it's the home stretch now. I remember my mum always saying when you're in the middle you just feel like you're in the middle of the ocean and you can't see land and it's just horrific.
Yeah.
And you know, it's tough. I've never written a book to order before, so it's just this wonderful thing between thinking this is wonderful, I've got a book. They bought the book before it's written.
Yeah.
And then, oh God, I've got to write it now. Just, people are waiting for it.
It's a strange sensation, isn't it? Here's some money. Can you please go make some stuff up?
Yes.
But like you say, it's a nice problem to have.
Yeah.
So how does a typical working day work for you with your two young children? I presume they're still school age children.
Yes. 8 and 5. Yes.
Yeah.
So I thought that when I got to write for a living, which is what I've always dreamed of doing, that I would be able to kind of write all day. And I do as much as I can, but I still find that I find writing at night is when I get the most writing done, because that's the habit I got into when the children were little, because the only time I could write. And I kind of forced myself, I used to be a bit of a morning person and I'd be in bed by 9 o'clock, but I forced myself to stay up because I just really wanted to get the girl in the letter written. And Ellie was a baby. So I got into this habit of writing sort of from about 8 till 1. And that is still when I get the bulk of my work done now.
Really?
Yeah.
Fascinating.
I know, because in the day, it's just the phone rings, that my email goes, the front door goes. There's a pile of laundry that needs sorting. I need to go food shopping. Grace needs a costume for school. You know, it doesn't stop. Life doesn't really stop in the day. But then when everyone's asleep, then I can really concentrate because I know I'm not going to get interrupted.
You've got that nice stretch of time.
Yeah.
Great. That's really interesting. So I just wondered if you wanted to let the listeners know anything about your social media accounts so people can follow you. You're on Twitter,
Instagram and Twitter, and Emily Gunness, and Facebook as well. I'm not very good at Instagram. I much prefer Twitter because my life is quite boring. All I do is, you know, pick my children up from school and write and, you know, occasionally see my friends for a glass of wine. So Instagram is very beautiful and I think you need to be out, you know, doing beautiful things. And I'm normally like at muddy farms with the children all the soft days. There's not really much beauty in my life at the moment, apart from my girls. So I much prefer Twitter because you can just quickly write something, or, you know, something funny that's made you laugh, or something that's happening, exciting that's happening. So, yes, I'm getting the hang of social media. I wouldn't say I was brilliant at it yet, but I'm getting the hang of it.
Yeah. So we can find you on Twitter. Do you have a website at all?
I don't know. I'm not famous enough for that yet. I don't
know. So we can just find you on Twitter,
yes.
Instagram and Facebook. Brilliant. Yes. Well, thanks ever so much for joining me today on Sniffing the Pages. And good luck with your publicity day, which is the 4th of April, isn't it?
Yes, I'm so excited.
Are you going to be doing anything?
Fabulous.
Yeah, my publisher's taking me out for dinner, which I'm very excited about. And then me and Steve are going to go to a bookshop and buy my book, which we've wanted to do for years.
Oh, so that's such a lovely thing to do.
Very excited.
Oh, brilliant. I'm really happy for you, and I'm so excited about the second book coming out as well.
Oh, thanks, Nina.
Wish you all the best with everything.
Lovely. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks very much, Emily.
Bye.
Bye.
And now we've reached the part of the show that we like to call What Katie Read Next. And this week, Katie has been reading The Strawberry Thief by Joanne Harris.
Yeah, so this is a follow-up to Joanne's first book, Chocolat. And there have been a couple of others that have been in that.
Yes,
so one's called,
she did Chocolat, then there was The Lollipop Shoes, then there was Peaches for Monsieur, and it's one of these characters, I can't remember, Monsieur somebody. And I have read those.
Yeah, I think I've read one of them, but not anyway. To be honest, I don't think it matters if you haven't. I've read Chocolat, and I've read
things, doesn't she?
Lollipop Shoes. I don't think I read the other one. Maybe I did. Anyway, so it's back in this world. So I'll read the blurb quickly, with some really, really bad French pronunciation. So you know. So Vienne Rocher has settled down. Lansquenet-sur-Tarn, the place that once rejected her, has finally become her home. With Rosette, her special child, she runs her chocolate shop in the square, talks to her friends on the river, is part of the community. Even Reynaud, the priest, has become a friend. But when old Narcisse, the florist, dies, leaving a parcel of land to Rosette and a written confession to Reynaud, the life of the sleepy village is once more thrown into disarray. The arrival of Narcisse's relatives, the departure of an old friend, and the opening of a mysterious new shop in the place of the florist across the square, one that mirrors the chocolaterie and has strange appeal of its own, all seems to herald some kind of change, a confrontation, a turbulence, even perhaps a murder. So
I'll let you say what you thought of it, but I've literally just started it, and I had no idea, because I didn't even read the blurb, I had no idea what it was going to be about, but I'm so pleased that it's about the little girl, who's Rue's daughter, who's Johnny Depp in Chocolat, for all you listeners.
I had not remembered that. I loved it. I really enjoyed it. When I first started, I really struggled to get into it, and I think it's because I was trying to read it too fast. I was trying to sort of treating it like a page turner, and that's just not what kind of a book it is. It's really, like, Joanne Harris's use of language is so beautiful and so evocative. You have to read it slowly and just sort of sink into it and enjoy that and appreciate it. The themes of it are sort of children growing up and growing away from you, and I just thought it was a beautiful book. I really liked it. Anyone who enjoyed Chocolat or any of her other books would definitely enjoy it.
Mm.
And it's her way with words, her language is just beautiful. The way she describes things, the way she describes their relationship with the wind and nature, it made you feel like really connected to it. It made me want to kind of go and walk in the woods and stroke the trees, listen to the wind, and it just felt quite connected to it, and it's that power of language. And it made me feel really emotional at the end. I didn't sort of full on cry, but there were bits where I was sort of like,
looking forward to another big cry. I love the way that she just transports you to those French streets, those little cobbledy streets.
It's such evocative writing. And yeah, it's a book to sort of really enjoy and indulge in, and it's not a sort of race through it at breakneck speeds.
No.
Oh my God, I must know what happens next kind of novel. Although there is a sense of suspense and finding out. There's this confession that's left by Narcisse the florist, and you're sort of getting snippets of that as you go through. And there's this wanting to find out what the story that he's telling.
Mm.
So there is definitely a kind of sense of suspense, or you know, what happens next, but it's not this sort of pacey page turner. It's just a really beautiful piece of writing,
and it doesn't have the same ye olde feeling as the others, does it? Because there's talk of modern day technology in there, and phones.
Yeah, so it is a bit more modern. I mean, I can't remember how many years after it is.
I think it's about hang on, what is
her daughter Rosette is 16 in it, so
it's 16 years, isn't it? Since Chocolat, she was got pregnant by Johnny Depp from Chocolat, all you listeners out there.
So 16 years on, so things have moved on, and it is, even in rural France, I guess, a bit more modern. Oh. Yeah, it was lovely, a lovely book. I think I gave it, I can't remember now, 4 out of 5. I think I was edging on 4.5. I remember sort of hovering,
trying to do that.
My
half
finger
star,
hovering,
but they
the
still don't
five,
let you do.
Like,
just let me do a goddamn half star.
Stop making me be so decisive. It doesn't come naturally. very much enjoyed it.
I'm very much looking forward to reading it, finishing it. Can't wait. For the next episode, Katie and I will be reading The Swap by Fiona Mitchell.
And Love and Other Things to Live For by Louise Leverett.
And both of those books are published on the 18th of April, so we're going to go away and read those, ready for next time. So that's all for today. Thanks for joining us. See you
and
next
thank
time.
You and good night, yeah.
Bye.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.